Session 23, February 5, 1964. The Early Sessions, Volume 1 of the Seth Material. Good evening, chicks. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, you never were proper Bostonians. I hope our little session last night was not too much for you. Rob, no, it was fine. Seth, it certainly didn't take you by surprise. However, since I felt that you almost expected me to visit. Rupert's suggestion concerning ESP cards is a good one. They are elementary, to say the least. However, they are good tools, and you could both benefit from using them and trying them out on others. The bakery across the street from Throckmorton's shop was run by a man called Reagan. Reagan, R-A-G-A-N. He had a wife, five children, and three children who died in their early years. He was a distant cousin of Throckmorton's, of Irish descent. The shop was directly across the way from Throckmorton's, and in like manner, the family lived upstairs and in the rear. A cobblestone street lay between the two shops. One of the small daughters, Anna, was the child with whom Dick played. One of the other children, a brother, is now one of your cousins, and another child is now a twin of Dick's present wife. There is, incidentally, a variant in the case of twins that I will go into sometime. The family was more prosperous than Throckmorton's. The house had two small extra rooms. The girl Anna married the other younger brother of Dick's, who also became prosperous in later years. The head of the family is also someone with whom you are acquainted, being in this life the husband of your present mother's niece. The English existence had much to do with your family and its relationships in this life. New challenges were set for the personalities. At the time, old challenges had been met and old debts had been paid to a large degree. I will not make this evening's session too long because of last evening's unscheduled one. However, as you have probably supposed by now, change of sex and race is the usual as far as continuing existences on your plane are concerned. As a rule, each entity is born so that he experiences at least three roles, that of mother, father, and child. I make three roles rather than two because a complete childhood, for instance, at least once, is usually necessary so that a personality can experience the knowledge of human growth. Of course, two lives would be sufficient to give you the three roles, but in some cases a personality does not function into adulthood and therefore does not experience motherhood or fatherhood. Also, for one reason or another, a personality may not have offspring. Besides the three necessary roles, there is another quality different in dimension, which is also necessary for the personality, and this involves the fullest use of potential. Lack of this last factor can cause a personality to be reborn more times on your plane than would be necessary if only the role requirement operated. This requirement for fullest use of capabilities has nothing to do with the opportunity in the social sense, although, of course, the particular social framework will have much to do with the particular development of certain abilities. The personality, when it leaves your plane for good, will have developed its potentials as far as it possibly can. This does not mean that all personalities who have left your plane are at the same level. Since their potential has individual variety, it depends a good deal upon the personality's ability to utilize energy as a unit or to transform energy into unit patterns. The ability to do this is not predestined in any way, shape, or manner, but it seems to be inherent, unpredictable, but one of the basic characteristics of any given fragment. I have only begun to go into this, but this matter is extremely important. Everyone who has left your plane has developed as far as he can on your plane. But as in your life, certain environments tend to encourage some people in the realization of their talents and seem to hinder others in the development of their particular talents, so some personalities expand in their capabilities on your plane, and some who do rather poorly on your plane expand surprisingly on other planes. This talent for using energy to form unit patterns is elemental, not only on your plane, but in all other planes. It involves drawing upon the basic vitality of the universe in using the inner senses and actually pulling to oneself more and more of this underlying vitality. Lest this suggest images of graspy pot-bellied souls gluttonously grabbing the stuff of the universe for themselves out of the mouths of the less ambitious, let me hasten to inform you that such is not the case. Rob notes, Jane's voice was still normal, and her eyes had their usual darker look. But by now, the rhythm of her pacing as she dictated Seth's messages had picked up quite a bit. She was moving about faster than ever before, so much so that I began to think it might be extremely fatiguing if she kept it up. Seth, in the first place, this vitality is self-generating and limitless. And we shall go into origins, reasons, and so forth all in due time. Nevertheless, as you do not deprive another of breath as you breathe, so you do not deprive another of the vitality of the universe simply by the act of using it yourself. We have, I believe, used the analogy of air, comparing it to the vitality of the universe in one of our previous sessions. As air is dispelled from the lungs in various forms and used and reused without any loss of power, strength, or quantity, so is the vitality of which we speak used in different manners. So does it enter as one thing many times. So does it emerge as something different many times. So does it change shape and content. So does it show many faces and yet never disappears. And as air seems invisible, so does this vitality seem invisible. And yet, like air, this vitality gives shape to every object that you see, and so does it form every camouflage. Without it, all camouflage would vanish. And so the ability to use this vitality well is as necessary to life as is the necessity to use air for breathing. I suggest you take a short break. Rob notes, Jane said the sentences making up this message were so long and involved that she made no effort to pay any attention to them while voicing them. This seemed strange to her, because as a writer, she is used to watching out for grammar, punctuation, etc. When I told her she had been pacing at a faster rate than ever before, she said it felt very effortless. She was not at all tired. This was the first time she had been aware of such a feeling. Seth, now I wish to make another point along these lines. No one, I am sure, denies the existence of air because ordinarily you do not see it. No one denies the existence of air because they do not understand the method by which their own lungs breathed. Yet they know that they breathe, and they know that without breath, death is inevitable. To deny the existence of air would seem ridiculous. It is just as ridiculous to deny this vitality because it is usually unseen or because you do not understand how you use it. Some part of the individual is aware of the most minute portions of breath. Some part of the individual knows immediately of the most minute particle of oxygen and components that enters the lungs. The thinking mind, or I had better say the thinking brain, does not know. Your all-important I does not know. In actuality, my dear friends, the all-important I does know. You do not know the all-important I. And therefore lies your difficulty. It is fashionable in your time to consider man or man's I as the product of the brain and an isolated bit of the subconscious, with a few odds and ends thrown in for good measure. Therefore, with such an unnatural division, it seems to man that he does not know himself. He says, I breathe, but who breathes? Since consciously I cannot tell myself to breathe or not to breathe. He says, I dream, but who dreams? I cannot tell myself to dream or not to dream. He cuts himself in half, then wonders why he's not whole. Even in my own lifetimes, on your plane, I sensed this basic contradiction. Man has consistently admitted to the evidence only those things he could see, smell, touch, or hear. And in so doing, he could only appreciate half of himself. And when I say half of himself, I exaggerate. He is aware of only a third of himself, because two-thirds of himself exists in that realm to which he will not admit. It is as if a man found himself in a completely dark room, to which no sounds came. And he looked down, could not see his body, could not hear his voice, and therefore deduced that he had no body and no voice, even though he knew he had both a body and a voice before he entered the room. Now he says, I will, at any moment, believe only what I can see. And though I am sure that I saw more at one time, now I can see nothing, and so I have no body since I cannot see it. With the hands that he does not think he has, our imaginary man then feels the contours of his body. But does this help him in his dilemma? No. He yells, witchcraft. If someone else says, oh, I feel a body, he says, you are a medium. Or if you prefer, a crackpot. The fact remains that you have within yourself the evidence. I suggest a brief break. You will notice, I am sure, that the brief breaks are getting briefer in duration, and yet I am letting you break more often, but for shorter periods. This material, you will find, will be a basis for other material that will come, and I prefer to give it to you before you go any further into a study of time. If man does not know who breathes within him, and if man does not know who dreams within him, it is not because there is one who acts in the physical world and one completely separate who dreams and breathes. It is because he has buried the part of himself which breathes and dreams. If these functions seem so automatic as to be performed by someone completely divorced from himself, it is because he has done the divorcing. This is not the case on all planes. It is not even the case on planes that you might consider lower than your own. Nor is it the case with some portions of life that you consider beneath you on your own plane. It is not in any manner inevitable or a law of the universe. Far from it. For some reason, mankind as a species on your plane has become much more attached to its camouflage patterns than most other kinds of consciousness. And with some important exceptions, all types of consciousness do have their particular camouflage patterns to which they more or less adhere. It is on your part more than anything else, a simple refusal to admit into existence anything that is not a camouflage pattern. Camouflage patterns are, of course, with again some exceptions, essentials on any plane, since each type represents the actual form of the plane and the various characteristics within it. Nevertheless, it is possible, and actually much more efficient and simple, to accept this fact and to realize and admit the inner vitality behind the camouflage. I mentioned somewhat earlier that oftentimes the consciousness becomes the subconscious and vice versa. This should certainly come as no surprise. You are familiar with it in your everyday existence. It is not some isolated occurrence that happens once in a lifetime, and yet as a rule mankind has ignored this completely. In sleep, the conscious becomes actually the subconscious, and the subconscious, in the more real manner, becomes conscious. Every man instinctively knows this simple fact, and yet every man stubbornly refuses to admit it. The part of you who dreams is the I as much as the part of you that operates in any other manner. The part of you who dreams is the part of you who breathes. And this part is certainly as legitimate and actually more necessary to you as a whole unit, as far as survival on your physical plane is concerned, than the part who also plays bridge or scramble. It would seem ludicrous to suppose that such a vital matter as breathing would be left to a subordinate and almost completely divorced, poor relative sort of a lesser personality. As breathing is carried on in a manner that seems automatic to the conscious mind. So, this important function of transforming the vitality of the universe into pattern units also seems to be carried on automatically. But this transformation is not as apparent to the one part of yourself that you are pleased to recognize, and therefore it seems as if this transformation is carried on by someone even more distant and alien than the unrecognized part of yourself that breathes. You would most probably not even admit that you breathed at all if you did not have tangible evidence before your eyes. And yet you have the evidence of the camouflaged world of physical appearance before your eyes. You accept it and make up far-fetched fantasies to explain its existence rather than face the facts. The facts are simply that you yourselves form these camouflage patterns. And I repeat this simple statement. You form the camouflage world of appearances with the same part of you that breathes. You do not admit the breather as really being a part of yourselves, nor do you admit the creator of the camouflaged physical world as being a part of yourselves. Because you know that somehow you breathe, without consciously being aware of the actual mechanics being involved, you are forced, despite your inclinations, to admit that you do your own breathing. When you cross a room, you are forced to admit that you have caused yourself to cross the room, even though consciously you have no idea of willing the muscles to move or of stimulating one muscle or another. And yet, even there, though you admit these things, you do not believe them. In your quiet, unguarded moments, you will say, "Who breathes? Who dreams? And even who moves?" How much easier it would be to admit freely and wholeheartedly the simple fact that you are not consciously aware of important, vital parts of yourself, and that you are more than you know you are. But since it is so difficult for man to even recognize the self that moves his own muscles and breathes his own breath, then I suppose it should not be startling that he cannot realize that this whole self also forms the camouflaged world of physical appearance, in almost the same manner that he forms a pattern with his breath upon a glass pane. Again, I suggest a brief break. Rob notes, during break, Jane seemed to become aware of several things at once. She said she thought she'd been in a trance of some kind almost from the beginning of the session. She had no memory of giving the above monologue. She said, "It was as though she had vanished." I told her that, of course, she was with me all the time, pacing so fast that at times it was distracting. The material, she said, came through with no distortion at all. She felt as though she were a pure vehicle. She had no conscious thoughts about it. She was hardly aware of her environment at all. She had a vague memory of picking up a wine glass once. Actually, I had watched her smoke a couple of cigarettes while dictating, pace back and forth, pause to look out the window, etc. She did not feel tired, nor had her voice shown any changes. Jane also now became aware of her fat hands again. She said they felt as though they were flesh between the fingers that she was not used to having there. She examined them. They were wet, and to me the fingers appeared thicker. Again, she could not get one of her rings back on. Seth. Without knowing what he was doing, Rupert has been developing his inner senses to an almost amazing degree, but naturally he did this unknowingly, pursuing other aims. In the past, he was so bound to the conscious ego that in fiction he found it difficult to write anything that was not strictly autobiographical. The poetry has always been the result of facility in use of the inner senses. But until lately, he was unable to give this sufficient pattern in terms of unitary form. His efforts in the book, The Physical World as Idea Construction, represented a breakthrough on his part. He realized, I believe, from the beginning, that the conscious critical mind had little to do with the initial conception. The book was a first attempt in forming a definite pattern of material that he was receiving from the inner senses. He was beginning to recognize the whole self. The only reason the whole self is not much more conscious and accessible, is your own stubborn refusal to admit it. I cannot emphasize this more strongly. The camouflage pattern world is formed by the mind, and I am using this now in its true term as a part of the inner world. Energy is received by the mind through the inner senses and transformed by use of mental enzymes into camouflage patterns. There is no reason why mankind cannot be aware of this transformation if once he admits into existence the whole self which makes this possible. As I mentioned earlier, the process of breathing seems automatic, and yet some part of you is aware of the most minute portions of air that inflate the lungs. You, or the part of you that are pleased to call yourself, refuse to admit, as part of yourself, the I that is aware of every breath you breathe, every move you make, every dream you dream. In other words, breathing and dreaming are not automatic, nor do they operate without your knowledge. Mankind simply refuses to admit the breather and the dreamer. Rob notes, now Jane's delivery was really wound up. Though she did not talk much faster, she emphasized the words more, used more gestures, and paced about even more rapidly. However, I had the feeling she was not in as deep a trance state as before. Her hand still bothered her also. She had taken off one ring at the start of the session, but had left her wedding ring on. Now she was trying to get that one off too, but without success. Seth. In many cases, he refuses to admit the mover. He trusts himself much more when he says, I will read, and then he reads, than he does when he says, I will see, and then he sees. He remembers having learned consciously to read, but he does not remember consciously having learned to see. And what he cannot remember consciously, he fears. And what he fears, he simply denies existence to. The fact is, he sees, although no one taught him how to see. And the part of himself that did teach him to see still guides his movements, still moves the muscles of his eyes, and still becomes conscious despite him when he sleeps, still breathes for him without thanks, without recognition, and still carries on his task of transforming energy from an inner reality to an outer camouflage. He becomes trapped by his own artificially divided self. He looks for gods, anything at all, to explain perfectly natural functions that belong to him. This beautifully absolves him, in his own eyes, from all responsibility. But it does not. I have been speaking here only, if you will believe it, of personalities in their particular lives as they operate on your plane, and I have much to say. You must remember, and this is, I'm afraid, a sideline, but I must communicate this data to you by words which must necessarily be strung out in order, end to end, when now to me there is no such necessity. And I will go into this further. As I began to say, I have been speaking of your plane and the personalities upon it. Now I will go into this further, into the entities involved. It is true that as a rule you are not aware of your whole entity, which, as a rule, does not reside within your boundaries. But there is no reason why you must be blind to the whole self of your present personality, which is part of your entity, and which can be glimpsed on your plane in terms of the breathing and dreaming self of which I have spoken. Another thing, it is in some ways convenient that you are not consciously aware of each breath that you take. But it is sheer stupidity to ignore the inner self which does the breathing and is aware of the mechanics involved. What you almost get here is that some little unknown self performs these necessary functions, and that is not the case. I have said that the mind is a part of the inner world, but you have access to your own minds which you ignore. And this access would lead you inevitably to the truths about the physical world. Working inward, you could understand the outward so much more clearly. Because I say that you actually create the typical camouflage patterns of your own physical universe yourselves, by use of the inner vitality of the universe, in the same manner that you form a pattern with your breath on a glass pane, I do not necessarily mean that you are the creators of the universe. I merely am saying that you are the creators of the physical world as you know it. And herein, my beloved friends, lies a vast tale. Nor do I know all the answers. It is, however, a fact that even mankind, in his blundering manner, will discover that he himself creates his own physical universe, and that the mechanisms of the physical body have more functions and varieties than he knows. Nor, in the sleeping state, are these functions stilled. They continue in an even more direct form than they do when he is awake. He creates when he dreams, in a truer, less distorted fashion, and his physical world is much more the product of his dreaming self than it is of his waking self. This is not meant to discourage the intellect, but the intellect has never yet been used for the purpose of which it was developed. I suggest a brief break, and may I say that I am unusually pleased with tonight's session and with Rupert's performance, since this material is coming to you without any distortions whatsoever, as far as I can tell. This is indeed our best session to date. Rob notes, break 11:18. During this monologue, Jane was not as far out, she said, yet was still away while talking. The phenomenon persisted with her hands, though to a lesser degree, but she still could not get her wedding ring off. Through this session, her voice had been normal. However, when she resumed dictation, her voice abruptly changed pitch, rising several notes up the scale. It was not a falsetto voice, yet was close to it, and was the first use of this kind of voice. She maintained it until the close of the session, along with her fast pacing. Seth, time is one of your most obvious camouflages, and the study of time will lead you, in a fairly direct manner, from the camouflaged physical self to the inner self which you ignore. Even now, your psychologists speak of the difference between physical time, by which you set your clocks, and psychological time. Psychological time, so-called, belongs to the inner self, that is, to the mind. It is, however, a connective, a portion of one of the inner senses, which we will call for convenience the second inner sense. Our physical time is a complete camouflage, unnecessary basically on your plane, but you have made it seem necessary because of your refusal to admit the inner self as part of your whole personality, and therefore you have not been able to utilize psychological time to its fullest advantage on your plane. Psychological time, as I have said, is a natural pathway, part of an inner sense that was meant as an easy access from the inner to the outer world and back again. You do not use it as such. This is one of the reasons why breathing seems automatic and why dreaming seems to confound your physical camouflage idea of time. It is perfectly within your present capabilities to understand that time to your dreaming self is very much like time to your waking self, your waking inner self. But you must first disconnect the physical concept of time and watches. This concept is one of the easiest to explore, yet as I have said, your clock time is one of the most artificial of your camouflages. The time concept in dreams may seem far different than your conception of time in the waking state, when you have your eyes on the clock and are concerned with getting some destination, say, by 12:15. But it is not so different from time in the waking state, when you are sitting alone in a room with your thoughts, and with no particular need to get anywhere. You will, I am sure, see the similarity now between this inner, alone sort of psychological time experienced very often in waking hours, and the sense of time experienced in dreams. This is meant to show you but one more point of similarity between the waking and sleeping selves. In other words, it is meant as another proof that they are indeed but one self, and that any divisions between them are artificial. The intellect is extremely important in the manipulation of camouflage patterns once they are created. You have made your world, and your intellect should help you deal with what you have created. It has other vital functions, which I shall enumerate at a later date. However, I cannot say this too often. You are more than your conscious mind, much more. And the self, which you do not admit, happens to be the portion of yourself which not only ensures your own survival in the physical universe which it has made, but which is also the connected portion of yourself with inner reality, which is, when all is said and done, the only basic reality, and which also continually enables you to create these camouflage patterns, and which contain knowledge and intuitions and memories which you need in a most desperate manner if you are ever to understand yourselves, and if the race of mankind is ever to evolve to its fullest. It is only through the use of this inner man, through the recognition of the functions of this inner man, that the race will ever use its potential. The outer senses will not help man to achieve the inner purposes which drive him. Empathy is an outer materialization, very superficial, of the first inner sense, which we have discussed so briefly. Unless man learns to use this inner sense, he may well lose whatever he has gained. I will say much more along these lines at a later date. I believe I will close the session. I do not want to keep you up too late, although, as usual, I could keep on for hours. I am extremely pleased that we could come together in this manner. A certain development on your part was absolutely necessary before such sessions between us could take place. A capacity to use your inner senses to some extent was necessary. I cannot explain fully, but I was dependent upon some of your abilities to some degree, and I will go into this also when I get to it. If you prefer to take a break and continue, that is perfectly all right with me. However, I will leave it up to you both. Rob notes, Jane failed about the same as she did at our last break. Now that the session was over, she realized that she'd had hardly any consciousness of what was going on through the whole thing. Yet, she didn't feel as tired as usual. We had little thoughts of continuing, however. Well, Seth, that was great, but we've decided to call it a night. We said goodnight on the board. Gratis. Seth, bravo. Good night, yes. Rob, Jane said the bravo referred to the session, end at 11:51.